Welcome to Business Watch. It's been a busy period for mining powerhouse Anglo American, formally bidding farewell to its turnaround CEO, Mark Cutifani, dubbed the Rocket Man by the Financial Mail recently, and releasing a rather disappointing first quarter operating update. A 10% production decline blamed on some wet weather in Brazil and South Africa as some of the key factors behind that. Now, since Cutifani took over the reins from Cynthia Carroll, who was criticized by analysts for overpaying on Minas Rio, the group has weathered some really tough times, but last year more than doubled its earnings and paid out a record $6.2 billion to its shareholders amid soaring global prices for commodities and really solid performances from its operations. Its share price has now topped £40, more than three times what it was when Cutifani embarked on the restructuring in mid-2013, and almost 20 times its early 2016 low. The group has outperformed its mining industry peers like BHP Billiton and Rio Tinto over the last 9 years, delivering an annual average 20% total return to shareholders, which beats Cutifani's 15% target that he set for himself. Mark, against that backdrop, welcome to the show. Now officially the former CEO of Anglo American, and time, I think, to reflect on a truly remarkable tenure. What goes through your mind at a moment like this?
Well, thanks, Michael, and always happy to chat. I don't know. One finds yourself reflecting on what you've learned and thinking about where to from here. But mostly, it's about people you've met, people you've done some really hard yards with, people that you've connected with and built relationships over time. A very important part of that has been the work we've done in South Africa. So it's all of those pieces. It's a mixed emotions thing. I'm not sure how else to describe it.
Yeah, it is a mixed emotions thing, but I'm sure you're appreciating signing off on a high and being able to, you know, prove many of the doubters back in 2015 who didn't believe you could achieve what you've achieved wrong. Now, you've got mining in your veins. Take us right back. What got you started in the business down under?
I've told this story a couple of times of late, but I was booked, or I'd actually been accepted to do law in Sydney, and that was where my father felt that I should head, either law or medicine. I said I didn't fancy digging around in people's stomachs, so law seemed a much better option. But as I got close to it, we're a working class family, so I would have to work my way through, and I was talking to a friend who worked in the mining industry, and he talked about a cadetship that he got the year before working for a CRA company, which is sort of Rio Tinto today, and he said, look, there's one going at our colliery, but there's about 100 to 150 candidates, and I said, well, can you throw my name in the ring? We'll see how it ends up, and in the end, I got it. And that for me was a more attractive option because the university was a local university. I could actually work, be paid at the same time. And so it seemed to solve a couple of things. And mining seemed to be interesting. I gave myself 3 months and said, well, if I don't think this is the right decision, I still got law I can go back to. And yeah, here I am 45 years later.
And your father at the time, what did he make of that choice?
He was disgusted, to put it bluntly. Well, he was Italian. He was Italian, for him, working class, you know, you had to sort of the first one in the family to go to university. It had to be either law or medicine. And when I told him it was going to be mining, I think he had images of Welsh coal mines, you know, how green is my valley type stuff. Couldn't believe I could make such a stupid choice.
Well, with the benefit of hindsight, I'm sure it's a choice that he's smiling on at the moment. Now, I ask because the industry is something also of a pipeline problem, certainly here in South Africa. The younger generation want to work in tech. They want to work in services. And often when I chat to mining CEOs, it's a big issue. How do you think about developing that pipeline of talent to get into the mining industry?
Well, I think we've got to do a better job firstly, selling what mining does and how important it is in society. I don't think we do a good job on that. Secondly, I think we have to help kids understand what choices there are in the mining industry. And you can literally go into anything or any field in mining, technical, it can be human resources, it can be finance. It literally offers you any choice you like. And I don't think we explain that very well. It's interesting, I've got two engineers, a boy and a girl, as children, and they're both electrical. But now they can see the technical choices in mining. They're starting to become interested in careers in mining, and I think that's a good thing. And I've got another one who's probably going to be a lawyer, political scientist. He's starting to think about mining on the corporate relations side. So I think we've got to do a much better job, but we've got to get to the kids earlier, probably in high school, actually.
Yeah, to show them that the pathway, especially in this world where we talk about, you know, the role of mining in responding to climate change and into developing a world that's more resilient. I think there's a lot more purpose in mining than potentially there's ever been. Now, when you took over back in 2013, the business was, to put it bluntly, in a pretty bad space. And then by 2015, you were confronted with some stark choices, I'm pretty sure. You're glad you never offloaded the likes of Kumba, for example. But that, I think that was on the table, as I recall. Just take me through that time and how you approached the slimming down of Anglo, or the pirouette, as you refer to it in that FM piece.
Well, if you go back to 2013, when we did our asset review, and Duncan Wonblack actually headed that. When we did the asset review, we identified, of the 68 assets we had, we identified 37 that we thought were the key value generators and the assets that we felt could do more and be part of the longer-term story. And there was about 30 that weren't really assets that were going to move the dial, and they were absorbing lots of time but not creating value. And for us, Rustenburg Platinum Operations was a good example, not because there weren't good people there, but from our point of view, the returns were tough and there were other assets that we were neglecting as a consequence of the amount of time spent working on assets that had very slim margins or a lot tougher and needed a different type of management approach. And I think those decisions were really important, and we identified 37 we'd keep in 2014. What happened in 2014-15, commodity prices kept dropping precipitously. China was looking looking a bit wobbly, and we were worried about a hard landing. And we still had $14 billion worth of debt, mainly coming from the Minas Rio adventure. So what I had to do was say, okay, of the 37, we identified around 12 of the assets, and we said, look, if we had to sell them, or if they had to sell something, what would you sell to deal with the debt? And we'd identified met coal, nickel, niobium phosphate, and possibly Kumba, because it was a part shareholding, that if we had to, we'd want to sell, we'd have to sell to cover the debt. Didn't want to, but we said we may not have no choice. So we started with the assets that we felt we could trade at reasonable value given the market. Niobium phosphate was the one that is the sale that we got away early. We also sold Tarmac, which is the construction business here in the UK, and we sold the smaller Rustenburg assets, and that did the trick for us. And so by mid-2016, we'd already made a sizable hole in the debt. We had a very good year in 15 where we dropped our costs 15%. And those things came together mid-16. We said, no, we're going to keep the rest of the asset, which is what we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so instead of the 37 that we targeted, we ended up with 35 of the 37. Unfortunately, I had to sell niobium phosphate to get the debt down, but that gave everybody the confidence to back us, and we've basically tracked up ever since.
Yeah, and I mean, some might say, well, you know, you rode the commodity cycle up, but what it speaks of too was taking those difficult decisions and reevaluating your approach to capital allocation. And speaking of capital allocation, I think the major mining houses have been remarkably disciplined through this part of the cycle this time round. Clearly an element of once bitten. But how long do you expect this to last, given where prices are for base metals, for green minerals, and the fact that we have such tight supply with this rising demand environment? It's all pretty tempting.
Yeah, one thing I would say, Michael, in terms of the description, people have said, yeah, we've ridden the commodity prices up, but what they forget is that of the assets we kept, on average, they're each delivering 30% more production than they were in 2013. Secondly, we're delivering twice as much production per person across the group than we were, and our real costs are down 40%. So there was a fair bit of self-help in what we did through that period, and we've also got the benefit of prices. So I'd say that about 60% of the improvement we've delivered has been self-help, and 40% has been the price movement over that period. So it's a bit of both, but the substantial change was the cost structures in the business and the improvements in productivity.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of prices and where they are today, I think the big challenge, because the industry has been disciplined, because the world keeps growing, and in particular we've got a growing middle class, we still need minerals and metals to feed that growth, and there hasn't been enough exploration and new project development to keep up with that demand. So demand is outstripping supply. It used to take about 7 years from discovery to development of a mining prospect, and it now takes somewhere between 15 to 20 years. And so we're not developing these things quick enough to keep up with where demand's going. If you look at copper, nickel, PGMs, and other products in the energy transition or even infrastructure, we're struggling to keep up, and that's a big part of why the prices are where they are today.
I was chatting to Bank of America Merrill Lynch researcher the other day about a report that they released recently called The Age of Scarcity. And it just talks about this that this rising consumption, and as we see, certainly in China, India, other developing economies, and their populations entering the middle class, they consume more. We just haven't been investing. Now, the long-term success of any mining business demands an optimal balance here between the sustainability of your operations, the option to grow, and the ability to return value to shareholders and obviously debt funders. And the problem is that mining is this highly front-loaded, capital-intensive industry. You've got relatively long time horizons. You've got longer-dated cash returns. So you carry this higher-than-average business risk in a complex environment. It's not just about digging holes in the ground. How do you balance that? How do you balance that equation, that need to grow and replace ounces, with that strict capital discipline?
So you've got to think long term, and you've made that point, I think, very well. We deplete our resources on an annual basis by around 3% through the process of mining, 3 to 4%. And so our average mine life today is around a bit over 20 years. What you've got to do is continue to rebuild your resource base as you go. So there's another capification through exploration, both new exploration, we call that greenfields, and extending existing operations, we call that brownfields, and even M&A, you've got to keep building the resource base to cover the stuff you've mined. Quite often, in our industry, leaders will go in and say, you know what, I don't have to do all of that much work. I've got 5 years where I probably don't have to do much rebuilding. And so they pull value out of the business, but they're not paying for the stuff that they've taken out. And so in 5 years' time, they're starting up to run against much shorter timeframes, and they struggle to hold their production base, their returns to shareholders, and they start falling away. So the key to this business is thinking long-term, putting a bit away each day, making sure you're keeping your reserve and your resource base at a good level. If you want to grow, you've got to actually invest in resources above and beyond the natural depletion rate. And that's tough. And when it becomes tougher to get to ground or get access to ground, or people don't like you developing their operations, or if they've got to, if they're going to be impacted, you've got to go along through a long consultation process. So it's getting tougher and more complex, and you've got to take a long view, and there's a lot of things you've got to invest in to make sure you hold those returns over the long term.
It's a really challenging role to head up a major mining house or mining company in today's world, and I think you really articulated that quite beautifully, Mark. Now, you were perhaps ironically the first mining engineer to run Anglo, almost the first lawyer, I think, as well, which started as a mining finance house by Sir Ernest. And I mean, his mate was obviously the mining guy, but really, that was its roots. Do you think that gave you an advantage looking through this as a mining engineer through that lens when you took over?
Well, I think it helps. But look, you don't have to be a mining engineer to run a mining company. You've got geologists. We've got different types of engineers. Duncan Wanblad, for example, is a mechanical stroke industrial engineer. That's a good skill to apply in mining. The advantage of being a mining engineer is you grow up with geology, the mining processes, and we understand, or you've got a better understanding probably of the infinite variabilities or variables that you can play with to extract the resource in the most efficient way. And you've got to understand finance, and you've got to understand how to set the business up to deliver a margin, deliver returns, return capital. So it helps when you know what you're looking at physically. But there's a whole lot of other work and a whole lot of other disciplines that you have to bring together to make the company work. So being a mining engineer is an advantage in terms of looking, knowing what you're looking at. But beyond that, you need a lot of other skills and training and people to make the business work. And that's the key.
Yeah. My late colleague and friend David Gleeson always said that mining is a volume game, tons to the mill. Quite simple. Get your grades right and it kind of seems like a simple game, but I mean, obviously you oversimplified that. What changes did you make to the way you approach this and the way you mind your ore body? Because what you spoke of earlier in that self-help story really is rather impressive and I think often overlooked.
So there's always a debate about ore bodies and how you mine them. And if I could just sort of create an image for people, an ore body is something that in many cases is quite variable. And so let's say it covers a depth of, let's say, 1,000 metres. The change in the nature of the ore body can be quite significant through that 1,000 metres, and I'm oversimplifying this conversation. Mm. So when you're mining, you have to keep adjusting the mining approach to the nature of the ore body. And there are other variables, the price of the commodity, all those sorts of things. You're constantly integrating and dealing with those issues. Now, at a GM level, at a general manager level, the guy who runs, man or woman who runs the site, they're usually there for 3 to 5 years, and they tend to think about that 3 to 5 years, make changes to get the best out of the business when they start, and then they get the operation in a flow. And quite often, if they know they've only got 2 years to go, they won't make another change that really is needed for the longer term, because in the end, it'll actually mean they produce less in their time frame.
Yeah.
We don't allow that to occur. What we do is from the centre, with what we consider some of the best brains in the world, we develop a mining strategy for the long term. And the GM has to follow that strategy with one caveat. We want you to improve, and this is the comment or the conversation we have, we want you to create more value and think of a better way, but you don't get to not continue to adjust to the ore body. And that's a very different approach. Yeah. And that, in my view, has helped us take a longer view and develop and continuously improve against this sort of feast and famine that we get as we change general managers. And that's a really important piece. And it's the role of the centre to make sure those ore bodies are mined effectively for the long term.
And it also speaks to someone who understands incentives here. And I think incentives are critical in business. And obviously, you know, if you're at the all face, you're going to do what you're incentivized to do ultimately. Now, if you look back on the last 9-10 years, what were the toughest parts of this entire process for you, and equally the most rewarding, as you sit here, Mark?
Toughest pieces were safety. When I started, we'd had I started in April 13, and for 13 we lost 15 colleagues. So safety was the toughest and most important area to work on. We haven't yet got to zero. We lost Carlos last year in Quellaveco in Peru. The good news is that we've made significant progress. So the biggest disappointment, we're not at zero. Probably my biggest satisfaction is we've reduced fatal incidents by over 90%. So good progress, but not yet done. As I said, that's my greatest disappointment. Good progress, environmental health, remarkable stuff. I remember joining Anglo at Anglo Gold back in 2007. And across the group, we reported more than 70 fatal incidents. That safety performance has obviously changed remarkably. But the bigger improvements, for example, we lost 1,000 colleagues to HIV. We lost, I think it was 93 colleagues to tuberculosis. We didn't lose anybody to tuberculosis last year. And we know of one, possibly two, recorded deaths from AIDS-related sicknesses. And so the health improvements have been remarkable, even far exceeding the impact we've had in safety. And so I'm most proud of those achievements and how we've played our role. Brian Brink, absolute legend in the industry, and more recently Elton Dorkin, have just been fantastic health practitioners for us as a business. And the difference we've made there is something that a lot of people are unaware of. So very proud of that. Productivity, we've doubled. We've taken lots out of our costs. We've got a growth profile over the next 10 years. So I think the business is set up for success. We've had the last quarter was very tough, as you saw. COVID impact, lots of record rains in both South Africa and Brazil. But we'll get through that, and Duncan will take the business forward. But certainly the prognosis going forward looks very strong. So we're proud of all of those things that we've done. But we also know we can do a lot better.
Mark, as we've just got a few minutes left, I think it's worthwhile now zooming out and looking at the environment here in South Africa in particular, because for much of South Africa's history, mining has been at the heart of the country's economic progress. It's an industry that's played an immense role in the development of South Africa. From the formation of the JSE, really that was built off the back of the gold mining boom in the 1880s, to the development of Joburg, the city itself. And in many significant ways, mining has spurred growth in South Africa over the course of 150 years. So it's a tragedy that we're now in the bottom 10 of the least attractive mining destinations, as ranked by the highly respected Fraser Institute. You've always spoken very positively about South Africa. What gives you confidence, considering that we are slipping down the rankings?
So I'm disappointed with the Fraser rankings. I think we're doing much better than people appreciate. And let me say it this way. In 2013, against our global peers, we were trading, and if you look at the price versus the asset values, we were trading at about a 40% discount against Rio, BHP and the other business. And they used to talk about a South African discount. Today, against those public NAV numbers and price, and we think our assets are worth more than are being reported publicly, but most CEOs will say that. But we're actually trading, or we're trading at a premium to those guys. Now, we're probably in line, given we've had a tough couple of days, but you know, that's a 40% swing, and it reflects, I think, a growing confidence in investors in South Africa's mining industry. And I think that we've seen improvements. We've seen a better dialogue between the industry and the government. We've seen genuine efforts to try and find a landing place on a whole range of things. I think we've still got a lot more work to do on the exploration policy work and other parts of the charter. But again, we've got a minister that will engage and is constructive in the conversation. He's also tough to negotiate with, but he does listen. And so I think we've got to keep working on that. And the other thing is, and Adrian Gore said this exceptionally well at the President's recent investment forum, it's about the dialogue around our own country. Mm. You know, I've worked all over the world, literally, in the mining industry, and there are very few jurisdictions, and I talk about South Africa being one of the top five. We understand mining better than most countries. Your 150 years is a testament, or at least explains the history. The policy framework continues to improve. I think the transformation work required post-94 was absolutely necessary. I think we've got to modernise that, but again, I think we're in the right types of dialogues. I think the Minerals Council is doing its best to represent the industry position, and I think we've now got to partner with the government in turning those Fraser rankings around. And that also means, as industry representatives, we've got to talk more positively and be more constructive in the dialogue. And that's my only issue, is let's debate the policy, let's debate it hard, but we have to be constructive.
Absolutely.
And I think that I see more negative comments about South Africa than I've seen anywhere else in the world, and I don't think that's fair.
Mark, you're a turnaround guy. Just as a last question, 30 seconds, would you ever consider taking up a post as the Minister of Minerals in South Africa? The Mines Minister joked at your farewell at Verkerlechen that he's going to make you an honorary South African. Your passport is in the mail. Would you do it?
I'd certainly take up the honorary citizenship, but I certainly wouldn't want to usurp the current minister. I think he's doing a good job. He listens. He understands the politics of the country much better than me, so I think he's far, far more and better qualified.
Mark, it's been a great pleasure, and I'm sure I echo all Anglo-American shareholders and South Africans in wishing you well and still hoping that we wallop the Wallabies at the World Cup in France next year. Take care.